because I'm starting really from the bottom, a perspective from the bottom up.
Which is the bottom? I never understood. Half the people at the bottom is one thing, and half is it the phenomenological side or the
I think I can claim the bottom for myself, not that it's usually a comfortable position, by saying that I am contemplating a kind of reduced number of new elements for the picture we already have now. Not enough new elements to solve the quantum gravity problem. Actually, explicitly not enough. So it's not, in that sense, it's bottom up because it's imagined as a first step in a direction. And from the premises, it couldn't be the full journey. So I claim the bottom.
Maybe we could start.
Okay.
So it's a pleasure to have Giovanni Amarino Camellia from the University of Rome. And he has a long title, so.
Yes. No, I don't know the title if it's fitting, and I already mentioned that what is the objective. I've given a couple other seminars at Perimeter, so you basically, some of you basically know this bottom-up approach, but just for, I have new keywords, so I like to play with keywords. I have a new string of keywords to use. So usually when you have a quantum gravity seminar is some attempt to resolve this very complicated problem. And traditionally the idea was that somebody or some group of people would have the right idea, and that one big magnificent idea would solve this problem pertaining to scales at least 17 orders of magnitude for particle physics and 29 orders of magnitude for gravity away from the scales we have control of. Maybe even get the theory of everything, but I will not comment on that hypothesis. The new string of keywords that I'm playing now is old quantum gravity theory, and I have to do this slide only to say this string of words, because the idea, I can't explain in these terms, the bottom-up approach that I'm adopting, if indeed, as many speculate, even among the advocates, and with good rights, I mean, of course, the first strategy, the traditional strategy, in some sense, I don't think in a correct way, but it could be argued that is inspired by the way Einstein got to general relativity. One big idea. I think it's historically incorrect, but this is something that you can debate. Okay? Now, what is the historical reference for the approach that I'm proposing? And why I say now, I like to say that not me, not only me, but the community adopting this approach is looking for the old quantum gravity theory. The idea is that we are imagining that we are not able, as human beings, right now, 17 orders of magnitude away in one direction, 29 orders of magnitude away in another direction to get the solution in one big jump. And maybe we are in a situation more analogous to when quantum mechanics came to be. And you know, of course, nobody could dream quantum mechanics the day after Planck proposed the solution of the black body radiation. It was beyond human possibilities. It took roughly 3 decades of very rudimentary, clumsy modeling of fantastic new effects, like Einstein's description of the photoelectric effect. Rebogli's grandfather, in Italy we say that grandfathers come when you sleep and they give you a good idea. And Rebogli's had a really beautiful grandfather that gave me that beautiful idea, and the Bohr atom, and the list is so long. I mean, the old quantum theory is perhaps the most beautiful season of physics, of the history of physics, and what I'm selling you, and that we should prepare to have such a beautiful season. Not the end of everything, but a season of puzzlement and wonder. But, of course, there is only one way for us to gain access to that beautiful season, which is experimental. So I have to So after this short but ambitious speech, I have to convince you that there is at least a slim chance that we can indeed gain access to this fantastic season that I imagine of puzzlement and nothing working. And since this will require experiment sensitive enough to uncover manifestation of the quantum gravity realm. And I cannot summarize, the community has grown rather significantly over the last decade. It remains a small community in comparison to more traditional ones, but is growing and active, and so I cannot even in 1 hour summarize all the research lines that are starting or have already been developed to some point. I will focus more on one or two illustrative examples of the way in which this program I see fit to try putting forward, and especially trying to convey the message that there is at least a slim chance that we can have experimental access to aspects, little fraction, little segments of the quantum gravity realm. Let me start with the idea that it's most easily explained and also was more widely discussed. This is basically originates from works in some attempts to model quantum space-time. So not all of quantum gravity, of course, but the quantum gravity problem invites, many people would agree, a description of space-time that is new. We call it quantum, but it's not clear that it has to be quantum and in which sense, but it's a new geometric language. And of course, there should be a quantum gravity in this new geometric language, but we just do, say, particle physics for the time being in this bottom-to-top approach. We start doing, actually, particle kinematics, really. This first part of the presentation is particle kinematics in a non-classical space-time. And this, the best efforts, and still not fully worked out, but close to being fully worked out, are studies that adopt space-time non-commutativity. And on this, we can, I have some slides, which I'm sure we'll not have time to show, but if there are questions, we can discuss them. And also, loop quantum gravity remains, I think, a debate on how to properly describe the semi-classical limit. Some authors have worked at some attempts to give shape to this idea of the semi-classical limit, and they also found modifications of the energy-momentum relation. Okay. This would be exciting, especially because this is something we can test very well. So it would be a case where indeed you have some idea inspired by the quantum gravity problem that you can go and test. But even when you have an effect as striking as this, a modification of the on-shell condition, you could have imagined 50 years ago that, well, is first I don't like it, but then it's probably not testable. The two statements are not logically coherent with each other, but the second one may be correct, meaning this effect is very small if lambda is the Planck length. So we not only have something staggeringly new, but we cannot even test. Well, we can test. This is by now a mature subject. And the best laboratory, there are others, and it's important that there are also others, but the most natural laboratory, of course, is not terrestrial. On terrestrial scales, if lambda is the Planck length, as I was suggesting, on terrestrial scales, this modification is never appreciated. But on cosmological scales, it can be. And the gamma ray bursts in particular are at first sight, then in the detail, they're a little less ideal than they seem, but they're still good. But at first sight, they're really ideal because we observe them now up to photons. These bursts, we see from these bursts photons of energies nearly up to 100 JeV. And the emission of these photons, we have robust ways to deduce that they are simultaneous on a time scale of seconds, And actually, what we expect when the statistics increases and our familiarity with these explosions improves is that we may be able to associate burst to a microburst within the burst. This can last only fractions of a second, even a millisecond. So it's a race between photons of different energy with a rather sharp clock for the start of the race, and we have even better clocks. Of course, here we have nanoseconds, but they are wasted on a race with the start. It starts with second or millisecond precision. And the distance, so it's a long race, because the distance from which we observe this gamma ray burst is cosmological. Redshifts of a few are very common. Okay. And if you put in these numbers, and of course it helps that the distances are cosmological, okay? If you put these numbers, there is one plausible implication. From the modification of dispersion relation, this would suggest that the group velocity of a light wave has a dependence on wavelength, if you want. Here I have the momentum of the photons in the wave. And if you now study what is the effect of this momentum-dependent velocity on the arrival time, well, this is the contribution to the arrival time due to this propagation effect, this anomalous term, and of course comes out to be this one in flat space-time. This is just to give an estimate. I will have, of course, a more careful estimate in a few slides. But if we were just in flat space-time, using the scales that I described, you get an effect of a second. Okay, so just comfortably at the scales where the process we are studying is intelligibly analyzed. Okay.
You're taking M0.
For the photon, I'm taking M0. But if M is small, if you take M small, it's negligible at under GV. So it's not really a crucial choice. It's not very relevant to the point. Also for neutrinos, just because I will mention neutrinos, this is an important point. I should mention that we later speak of neutrinos just as if they were photons. Indeed, I expect them to have mass, but you know, at these energies, their mass contributes nothing to the delay, nothing of tangible. And this is the type of quality of data we have now from a burst. Of course, what you want to do is analyze the burst in different energy channels so that you have some kind of evidence. This is counts of photons in different energy channels. This is still relatively low energy, 5 MeV. This is above the JeV. And different energy channels, the time history of the counts of photons is really the analysis you want, because basically these are photons that raced through the whole universe. I mean, I find it, I wish the subway in Rome worked like that. I mean, this is after, this traveled for 10 to 10 years. And, well, for God's sake. So even just this fact, I think, deserves just breathe it in. Wow. Without quantum gravity or anything else. Just amazing. I'm... Anyway, they arrived together, for God's sake. Okay? So you see, after 10 to 10 years, there is if you just look at the main peak, it shows up roughly at the same time in every channel. But this is what expected with special relativity, and this is what expected also with that formula. But that formula would suggest that there are little biases in a delay in the arrival time at higher energies. Now, of course, this is exactly what seems to be shown here. But the analysis must be careful. But just to show you the quality of the data that we have now, we just have, if you look naively at this graph, you could argue that the high energy signal reaches 4.5 seconds after the low energy signal, the trigger. You know, the trigger at high energy is 4.5 seconds, just the order of magnitude expected. Okay. Of course, and many people contributed, I just advertised the little contribution Lee and I gave, but from this graph, what we can immediately say as a serious phenomenologist is that there is no propagation-induced delay of 10 seconds. We agree on that. This is the robust, relatively robust conclusion, is that there is no propagation-induced delay of 10 or 20 seconds. Now, this delay that we do see, we have to now understand if it's something that perhaps, as actually this delay here, is now, I think, robustly established that it is a property of the source. Because I said they were nearly ideal, the gamma ray burst. What is not ideal is that we don't understand them well enough. The modeling is still at a rather early stage of development. So it's not at all surprising. It was not completely expected, actually, to be honest. It was not expected at all. But astrophysicists are very quick. And just a few days after this data, it had been expected in many models. Okay. But this is not, I mean, this is just because it's a very challenging field. Astrophysics is trying to model sources on which we have only very indirect information. And indeed, all this field is very beautiful also because it's teaching us things about these sources. So you then, in the details of what this data show you, is that we have now the sensitivity to exclude the delay of 10 seconds on a journey of 10 to 10 years. Now, if you want, excluding is one thing. Discovering is a completely other thing. Okay? And for discovering, there are many issues that have to fight with our lack of understanding of the sources. And this is research in progress that, if you want, we can discuss after the seminar. For example, Lee and I and several other authors have argued that this delay from here and there could not be a propagation effect on the number of other, also looking at other data that, whereas perhaps it's tempting here, this is the second peak. This is the second peak looked in detail, and this fact that the second peak shifts with energy is perhaps more intriguing. So far, it's not something we can exclude as an interpretation, as a propagation effect, but chances are this is another property of the source.
Where is the second peak on the big graph, not the
inset. Here you see it more clearly.
Oh, it's this little separation?
This little separation. But there are, I mean, the astrophysicists, the telescope, those who run the telescope have statistical significance to discriminate between one and two peaks.
Johnny, what does it mean for the source, the second? Is it understood why there would be a second peak?
Well, this is a sequence of peaks, okay? And something that Fermi discovered through these observations is this tendency of having a couple of peaks close to each other, and the first peak is not present at high energies, and the second one is. But this is still, we are learning the...
It's typical for gamma ray bursts, but we don't really know why. Is
that it's frequent in gamma ray bursts, and we don't understand why. This is always true. But now these are the data with a few gamma. I've shown you one. We have actually three or four of this quality. But these analyses, and that, okay, remember this graph when I will make the point about redshift.
Is this all from a single burst?
This is from a single burst. Otherwise, I should take into account redshift. And in fact, the interesting analysis I will say in a second is when you have many bursts and you look for the propagation effect, not by doing some strange investigative works of features of the burst, if it can be the source or not, but by looking for a dependence of these delays on redshift. If it depends on redshift, then it's very likely a propagation effect. An effect which is due to properties of the source will not scale with redshift like a propagation that simply grows with the propagation time.
What's the negative? Why? What's the negative?
If God is evil, it's possible. But, I mean, you need sources that conspire to produce their delays just as a function of redshift of the precise type I will show you in a second, which is also a complicated function. So you ask me the question in a few minutes when you will see what the sources should do. They should really be smart. Evil.
What's a negative count?
What is negative what?
I'm not sure I'm reading that correctly, but there are things less than zero.
This is when you subtract background. When you subtract background, I mean, this is there is spectral subtraction, and sometimes you know it's an imprecise science. So this is not negative. This is not negative count of photons. It's just evidence of how noisy how noisy the signal is once you have subtracted the background. Okay. And of course, when you subtract the background, you can have negative signal formally. Of course, you don't have negative. So we are now at this stage, and I think what I should emphasize is that, because of course, bottom to top. Also, I remember, I'm taking, nobody's present, I should take revenge on. But I remember, so I'm taking revenge on absent people, but I remember 10 years ago, I was promised.
Being taped anyway, so.
Good. I remember 10 years ago, I was promised by some colleagues that in 10 years we will have a full solution of quantum gravity. I think also Lee was more optimistic 10 years ago. But I'm not taking revenge to
who
you.
Who made that promise?
I won't give names, but with lawyers I can give names, okay? And many people in this room know that there are big names. So I was promised 10 years ago that in 10 years there will be a full solution of quantum gravity.
I think I confess. I said
before. You said it, but you confess. And that you will not be in jail. I want to have other confessions. Anyway, I was promised and I haven't got it. So. So because it was strange, I made this story because now I'm going to say that it's very important for me that maybe in 30 years we can also test quadratic effect of this source by studying high energy neutrinos. When I was saying this 10 years ago, it was very funny because in the same conference there was somebody speaking of the fact that in 10 years the quantum gravity problem would be solved. And I was saying in 30 years we can have neutrinos, and it looked funny. Who cares about the neutrinos when we already have everything? Now, 10 years have passed, and my thing is that I still say in 30 years, because the neutrino observatories are not advancing as fast as I wished. But I made a smaller mistake than the other prediction. And
I'm sure they still say 10 years.
Okay.
Well, I mean, one very provocative.
No, but you know, Rob, it's not true. They don't say in 10 years. Actually, I've double-checked with some of my sources. They don't say 10, they say 20. And so this is very, no, this is important, however. It's not converging. It's not converging.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to be provocative in this audience, you can ask whether you'll have a detection of quantum gravity effect before or after a detection of classical gravitational radiation.
I hope after. I mean, I hope for them, because it's going to take us a long time. So,
if you want to ask this audience, I would say you already have a detection of quantum gravity. So then,
what is that?
It's cosmic acceleration.
Anyway, so this is very important. So this also gives you a time scale. I'm not joking. Actually, I'm not even sure that the plans for neutrino observatories have been delayed that much. But what I'm just trying to say, to me, is exciting that these sensitivities that we are now, some of us, so exciting about, are just the first step. And over one or two centuries, and don't laugh about it, in one or two centuries, I'm sure we will have incredibly better sensitivities. And to me, this is a program that one should imagine developing over centuries. Okay. So there is no 10 years promise being made. And great excitement for the prospect that in a few decades we might even test these type of effects with quadratic sensitivity, which was simply dreamed of 20 years ago. Now for the data, this is a slide where already Rafael's question allowed me to anticipate. I mean, we have what, and also Jurek, I mean, what we observe as a delay clearly is due in part to some possible contribution from the source and the contribution from propagation. In flat space, this would be a characteristic behavior of dependence on the time of propagation of the delay, and it would be difficult to imagine that the source, which doesn't know how long it has to propagate the signal, would also conspire to do that. I will now show you some formula.
There is one possibility, though, right? The further out you're seeing,
the earlier they are. Yes, some dependence. So some dependence would not be unexpected. Those are younger sources than the newer. The problem is whether that dependence manages to conspire to be exactly like a propagation effect. That, I think, instead is we can say it's very unlikely. But also there is another point. So this was to say that our ignorance of the source, this is assuming that we remain ignorant of the source, but with the time scales I'm announcing, centuries, perhaps this research could at some point be done by knowing what the source is the hell doing, which is not bad. Okay? So at the time being I'm really assuming we know nothing of the source. And in that case these issues are certainly important. Something else we have not dealt enough in the literature, some of you might not know, but I'm referring to flat space-time a lot because most of the work on this has been done in flat space-time. And I became very concerned about this only very recently because now we have the actual data. For the last 2 years, we have actual data of good quality. And, surprise, they're not from a flat space-time. And actually, it's crucial to exploit the more distant sources. Of course, the more distant sources, because of the logics I explained, are the most precious, but the most distant sources are the ones that require you to really take into account the expansion of the universe. To model propagation in flat space-time when you have distant sources at redshift greater than one starts to be reasonable. Okay? So it was a kind of an embarrassment at some point to realize that most of the work done on this was in flat space-time and really was not possible to compare it to the data, if not with an order of magnitude comparison. A few authors, just a couple of collaborations had tried to, very recently, however, in the last 3 or 4 years, they had tried to address this issue of dealing with expansion. And this is a very interesting issue that I, instead of going more on the technical details, I want to advertise today. What is being used in the recent literature to transform these data into experimental bounds are formula based on this description of a momentum-dependent speed of photons in presence of curvature. Okay? And here I've specialized the case of the Sitter expansion. It's still not realistic, but it's good for theories. This is the Sitter in conformal coordinates. Because I'm basically setting up an analysis on the next couple of slides of symmetries concerning the issue of symmetries, and those are more transparent if you focus on the Sitter expansion and conformal coordinates. And this is, therefore, anyway, the velocity formula that many telescopes have been using to test this effect. Okay? This was motivated by these authors, very plausibly, while thinking, however, of a conceptual framework. We haven't touched on that, which is, however, an issue dear to me. The assumption is that these modifications of the energy-momentum relation are due to a breakdown of Lorentz symmetry, a preferred frame. Okay? And this has been extensively tested. To go back to Jurek, God is evil hypothesis, in this framework that Ellis, Mavromatos, Sakharov, Nanopoulos, and Sarkisian, and Jacob and Piran eventually settled for, this gives a precise prediction for the redshift dependence, which is captured by this rather convoluted formula. So, if the sources want to be evil, they should mimic exactly this behavior in principle.
This omega is the cosmologist omega.
The other omega was the energy in some funny notation. This omega is a topograph. Thank you. Could be very misleading. These omegas are cosmological parameters because, of course, when you want to compare to data, you then put the actual expansion that is fashionable among cosmologists. So in the end, you have this definite prediction.
What's KE?
It's leftover. It's not there. Sorry, this was his. This formula starts like a formula with ke of z. I think this is what delta p. Yes, it's ke of z, and then I've left the k and I put the integral that explicitates k. Okay, apologies for that.
Where did they get this? I mean, it's just some ansatz, but it's motivated by what?
It's motivated by a certain intuition about how the symmetries are broken locally, and then. And I will not, I mean, it's a very plausible ansatz, but it is an ansatz. I would describe it as an ansatz.
Is it some effective field theory that they've
written? No, but there is a Hamiltonian. I mean, they propose to adopt. Oh.
Yeah, don't lose that.
There is a Hamiltonian description for this. It's really a very preliminary argument, like all that I'm saying, by the way. I will propose an alternative for this. Without any claim of it being less preliminary, but it's interestingly complementary to this proposal. Let me also mention something for the quantum gravity theorists in the audience. I mean, if this result, indeed, for the moment, let's treat it as an ansatz by smart people. So that deserve the respect of those who have thought about it, but it's an ansatz. And for it to be in a quantum gravity theory, it requires something. If this is really, I mean, this is intended as a leading order term. But it's illustrative to go up to, this is conformal time. I did not introduce this as standard notation for the Sitter space. This is conformal time. Let's go to very early conformal time to see what this formula would be formally saying. What it's formally saying is that a source at very early conformal time, with respect to the telescope, if it emits a soft and a hard photon, the hard photon first goes, this thing changes sign at some point. So the hard photon first goes that way, away from the telescope, and then goes to the telescope. Okay. So this is something that requires attention in this formula that has not been noticed. We realized this while looking for an alternative formula, and then we realize this formula, which doesn't necessarily mean anything particularly worrisome, because this has been truncated at leading order in lambda. So if you can imagine that there are additional terms where perhaps lambda times all of this is squared, you know, it could be that higher order terms cure this problem, cure this issue. But it will only apply in theories where this is the expansion quantity, the dimensional expansion quantity, and it would be interesting. I cannot imagine one, but it would be interesting if somebody with quantum gravity with other quantum gravity background can imagine corrections coming in with this rather specific dependence on both momentum and conformal time.
Just to understand, this is essentially what the Sitter, I mean the propagation of photons on the Sitter background with some Lorentz symmetry breaking piece put by hand, right? That's
yes.
Essentially just the kinematics.
Yes.
Okay.
You can do it with a Hamiltonian. I mean, you can introduce an Hamiltonian
sure.
produces that, but it's broken symmetry, so it's basically many things are conceivable.
This factor that you said change sign, do I really interpret that in terms of the De Sitter evolution? Because there, it's not going to change sign.
What is not going to say change sign?
Well, you showed me a formula that was basically the scale factor, so it goes to zero, sort of in the infinite, what I would call the infinite path.
Well, yes, but this is the inverse of the scale factor. So indeed, this is the problem, quote unquote problem.
It never changes sign.
It never changes sign, but when this goes to infinity, the velocity changes sign. It's exactly, I should have stressed that. This is what appears here is the inverse of the scale factor. When it goes to zero, this always is in the denominator, this always dominates over one. So it becomes something that goes in the opposite direction than the one you push it. You push it that way, it goes this way. It's very, we are prepared for counterintuitive things, but this is particularly, you know, I'm not, but probably there is a simpler explanation, is that such a formula makes sense only if you have a specific type of truncation. But then the problem becomes, do we have quantum gravity models that admit this type of power expansion, where you expand in, well, this is, you can rearrange it in other coordinates, but.
Well, aren't you just saying that expansion becomes nonsense when d goes to zero, because the higher order term would be comparable to the terms that you wrote down?
Yes. But then if it becomes nonsense, it's just the best tradition of physics. Now, when you truncate, then you know that there are some things you cannot describe. If the problem here is if it's still meaningful, if instead this was a, so if the higher order terms don't come out with the right, this is just to say we are at a very early stage also of the formalization, and there are opportunities for young people to do some good. I am, some of you know that I'm quite excited, besides also, seemingly breaking is very exciting. I'm also excited about the possibility that something like this might be the result not of a preferred frame, but rather of a deformation of symmetries. Okay? The idea that is pursued in this DSR literature is that you might have something like a modified dispersion relation, but also you might not have a modified dispersion relation and have maybe a modified de Broglie relation. You have some specific relativistic role for the scale lambda, for the Planck length, and this is not manifestation of a preferred frame of a breakdown of Lorentz symmetry, but rather in the same sense that the scale c, the speed of light, came about, first perceived as a manifestation of a preferred frame, as a property of the ether, and then understood instead as a manifestation of the laws of transformation between observers. The speed of light really is primarily in physics a parameter in the law of transformation between inertial observers. And so there is this alternative possibility with respect to the preferred frame picture of imagining that we now, as we approach, instead of much higher energies, we are now trying to explore the realm of much higher energies, we might discover evidence of a second relativistic scale. But this exercise, there is a large literature by now on this deformation of symmetries, these are just some of the first papers. All of this is in flat spacetime. And so we, in a recent study with Marciano, Matassa, and Rosati, who are brilliant students I have in Rome, we asked whether this construction that had been used by telescopes to match the data was compatible with the DSR idea. And actually, at least in a certain specific sense, it is not. So we were unable to find any deformation of the, say, the Lorentz sector of the de Sitter group that would leave invariant this, which is the invariant instead when the on-shell condition, if you want, that is used for those data analysis. And then we asked, can we find one? And we were successful by making the simplest ansatz. In some sense, when you look at it in conformal coordinates, the reason why conformal coordinates are useful is because in classical space-time, they allow you to basically reabsorb the expansion into the conformal time. This is really why you go to conformal coordinates. So, for example, and every relation is already, for example, the invariant, the Casimir, is the Minkowskian Casimir times something with the scale factor. So conformal coordinates are the point where being in the de Sitter space looks more similar to being in Minkowski space. Formally, of course, you're still in the de Sitter and not in Minkowski. This modification that has been tested produces in some sense, not only introduces the momentum dependence, but also spoils this property of conformal coordinates. If you're following my, I'm using very low quality English, but perhaps you know the stuff so good that you understand what I'm trying to say. Okay. So we just looked for a DSR realization of this scenario. So momentum dependent speed of light, finally with expansion of space-time taken into account, by making the ansatz that instead, to preserve the DSR, so to avoid having a preferred frame, this property of conformal time should be preserved. So we do introduce the momentum dependence, but still imagining that conformal time factors out all of the expansion, if you allow me this sloppy language. And we were successful in finding a deformation of boost of the same type that other seminars here have shown for other approaches to DSR formulations in flat space-time. We found a deformed, this is the classical de Sitter boost in the classical de Sitter boost in conformal coordinates. It's the first line, and this is the correction we could constructively obtain. And so we have now the velocity, of course, does not have this scale factor issue that we were discussing, because we have reestablished the traditional role of conformal time, of eating up the expansion. And we have an analogous but different formula for slightly different. You see, phenomenologically, the interesting point is that at low redshift, the two formulas, after all this work, and at low redshift, up to redshift of even 2, the two formulas produce basically the same time delays. But in principle, at redshifts where it's not, I mean, we have some bursts around here, around 4.4 redshift with good high energy emission. Up here, the difference between the two results is rather significant. And the fact that it's significant, I'm highlighting by somehow showing here, this is fiction, these bars are fiction. This one is a bit more significant, instead. This one is the statistical, forget systematic, statistical uncertainty of a specific burst, the quality of time delay of a specific burst. So this is true, but without systematics. This is true, and this is imagine to have bursts at higher energy with the same accuracy, at high redshift, just to show you that this big effort we did to produce a formula that is nearly like the other one, quantitatively, conceptually is very different, I hope it was clear. But it's very quantitative is very similar. Well, but there is a hope that actually the two things could be even distinguished, okay, in case of a positive result, which is. So there was a question.
Yeah. So you developed this formalism for de Sitter space, but then you're using it in our universe, which is not de Sitter.
So yes. Yes.
So how do you extend from de Sitter to?
Yes. Fair enough. I missed one jump. So this is. The point is, we are still making an ansatz. In de Sitter space, this is a result, in a de Sitter expansion. Mm-hmm. Now, how do I promote this to a formula for FRW? Not having such a constructive, because in our recipe, symmetries are crucial. I mean, we don't have a DSR recipe when there are no symmetries, or when there are fewer symmetries than a maximally symmetric space. So the truth is that we have a result in the Sitter, which is this. And we say that in FRW, we simply replace the scale factor in all formulas. We replace the scale factor of the Sitter with the scale factor of FRW. And this is an ansatz. Okay.
But do you know if that ansatz will be any more consistent than the LSB one was, which was not consistent according to
FRW? Depends. I mean, there is at least one consistency criterion, not consistency fact, but one consistency criterion. Clearly, this one satisfies and the other not. Is the consistency with the de Sitter maximal symmetric description. So with 10 symmetries in the de Sitter limit. But this is one of many, and maybe it fails. You know, I'm not saying, but there is one additional quality it might have, if you like that quality, or one of these additional unpleasant aspect, if you don't like it, that this thing has.
Yeah, the 905-10.
Yes.
You have error bars such that there's sort of a 1 sigma or 2 sigma quote detection of a delta T over delta P.
This is just, I'm trying to quantify here the statistical, no. I've just said that this is to qualify, I'm quantifying roughly the statistical uncertainty of the data, removing all aspects of the systematics, for example, assuming that I know the source perfectly. This is not the case.
So those are error bars at the limit, not error bars at the total
effect. One way to say is this. Yeah. Although you can always be conservative with the limit and remove the error bars.
Can you take the flat space limit of the sitter? Does this go over to what you already had in flat space?
Oh, yes. Thank you. Yes. That, however, I didn't mention it as a quality because not everybody must see it as a quality. But, of course, this then, when you take the scale factor to the Minkowski case, it's another scale factor, a particularly trivial one, this reproduces the formulas in previous works on the SI. But I didn't mention that as a quality. I showed earlier this feature that we have with this approach, with the symmetry breaking and with this type of velocity. Let me mention, since for a number of reasons it's popular in the literature, at least in coffee time discussions these days, let me mention that, of course, we have here a feature that Lee and I properly characterized already in other studies, which is that the proper way to say it, I think, is this. In this framework, in this description of the Sitter expansion, just like in other, the SR description in flat space, you lose simultaneity, distance simultaneity. You know that in relativity there is a delicate issue about distance simultaneity even in classical space. And what is very evident, if you do Boost transformations with these new rules, that you lose the concept of, you lose it completely, the concept of distance simultaneity. Meaning that two events which are simultaneous according to a distant observer Alice, simultaneous and at the same location, according to an observer Alice, they may not be simultaneous and in the same location according to an observer Bob, boosted with respect to Alice. Alice and Bob only agree in this formalism on the simultaneity of events with respect to which they are local. But they may disagree on the distant simultaneity. They may disagree on the simultaneity of events which are far away. This I should mention to balance, okay? This is something that some people are very concerned about this. It's a question of, I guess, taste if you're concerned, but it's perhaps also interesting. But this is somehow the deformed symmetry counterpart of this picture here, in some sense. Okay? This is a fixed frame picture, of course. It's counterpart, but complementary. Here we have some problem at very early conformal time. Here we have no problem for any given, no anomaly, no new feature, qualitatively new feature in any fixed frame. But because we have deformed the symmetries, we do expect some new feature when we boost, when we change, when we compare frames. And the new feature, quite strikingly, and this is something I don't have all, this is work in progress, but this was already understood in earlier papers separately by Lee and by me and Mercati, Matassa, and Rosati. I'm blessed with very brilliant students who can do all these things, and we independently arrived at this idea that you lose distance simultaneity. This is the price. So the price to go from Galilei relativity to special relativity was to lose the objectivity of simultaneity, trivial simultaneity. Galilei to special, you renounce to trivial simultaneity, but you still have simultaneity at the same point. Objective simultaneity at the same point, no matter how far it is from the observer. Now, introducing the scale lambda, it seems, at least this is the preliminary evidence that independently Lee and my students, with little help from me, found, is that The introducing this length scale appears to cost you the price of basically renouncing the last bit of distant simultaneity that you have. All you're left is with objective simultaneity established by local observers.
So if I understand this right, this would mean that suppose somebody wanted to ask if two events were simultaneous over there and they probe it with a photon of one frequency, they'd say yes, but of a different frequency.
Yes, this is one way. This is one way. And it's kind of obvious. I mean, the more distant it is, the more it makes a difference if you use the hard than the soft. If you're very close, if you're local, you can use the hard, the soft, it gives you. Please.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I understand this, which just since Giovanni mentioned it, is that there's a limitation on the extent to which one can extend the procedure that Einstein introduced to define an inertial coordinate system, right? With using Lagrange, as you say, to define, to give space and time coordinates to distant events. Because of ambiguities with the DSR transformations, or I think a better way to think of it is because of an anomalous spreading of the wave packet that comes in propagation of wave equations which are DSR invariant, there's a necessary fuzziness in what is the time coordinate of a distant event established by bouncing light signals.
So you really can't synchronize clocks properly anymore.
Right, so if you give
For example, you give me
a delta t to which you can synchronize clocks, and I'll give you a distance beyond which you cannot synchronize two clocks further than that away.
For any photon, or?
Well, but you have to use photons sufficiently energetic that their frequency is fast enough.
This depends also on the range of boosts.
Okay.
Depends also on the range of boosts. You have to give him probably a delta t and the range of boosts where you want the classical space-time picture to hold.
So in some sense, it means, unlike in the Einsteinian case where you can map out a certain unique structure of space-time, this problem is lost. Basically.
It's lost.
Another way to say it is that it's a different curvature is a reason why there's a limitation to the size of inertial frames. And this is something which is not curvature, but it's a remnant of quantum gravity that appears in non-commutative geometry in Planck space.
Okay. This is
Does that mean that for the gamma ray bursts, the received signals would be spread out?
No. This actually tells you that... This tells you that for the gamma ray burst at the telescope, there is actually a sharp distinguishing feature of the time delay for however arbitrary boosted observers. But if you go and map back these light rays to the source, you would find the source being bulky. So it's not here you get the same picture you would have expected. What changes is that if you try then to do the reverse history, you know, you go back in history and say, how was this source? The source looks more foggy than you imagined.
But you can turn it the other way around.
Akin is right.
Because you can look at the source, where for the source you have things happen where the source is, and it's measured at the source, and they would agree there that things happen at the same time.
Yeah.
So,
a way that in our joint paper we discussed this is that on top of the systematic drift of the arrival time with energy, there's a stochastic component, which also grows with distance.
Right, because the different events that would have emitted, that's to the emission of the different photons that you see, those would have happened in hindsight from the perspective of the astronomer, would have happened at not equal times, right?
Yes.
Or equivalently, there's a...
Yes, but then what we expect, although we don't have a definite construction, what we expect, this is something that maybe people like you, like who know op algebras of the Kappa Poincaré type, or maybe you should be contributing. What we expect that the mathematics should provide us is a proper concept of parallel transport, because actually you are imagining to go back to the source and to by a trivial parallel transport. But this is clearly what we have clearly understood, is that the trivial notion of parallel transport is, and you can see it, I guess, but not every, it's difficult to explain to other people, but a trivial notion of parallel transport is inconsistent with the deformation of the Lorentz that we have. So what is missing and is still missing, we have been discussing this week a lot, is a proper notion of parallel transport that would allow you then, you here see the source as more bulky than it actually is, but then there is a notion of parallel transport that takes you where the source is and it squeezes it back to its real size, the size for a local observer.
Yeah, but observationally, we can't do that for distant things, right? I mean, we can only know what we look at here. So that means, if I understand this right, that you're going to see some kind of fuzziness in the events. You're going to see time drifts. And so you run into this question of how do you know it's not the source versus
In the detail of the formulas,
yeah.
You have no ambiguity about what you see and the origin of the observer. What is changing between Alice and Bob give different picture of how delocalized is the source. But
this is certainly ongoing.
This is a more technical, but it's ongoing, and actually, I'm tempted to find fresh arms for the parallel transport issue. Anyway,
I phenomenological. So suppose I ask, we're sitting here, we're observing this gamma ray burst, but different times of the year we're moving at a different velocity or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some extra effect associated with that? Or you don't know whether there's some extra effect?
No, I just said that there is no effect. So the result is that there is no other effect, absolutely no other effect locally. Because a local observer sees a sharp picture. So the picture for two boosted observers but that share the origin is exactly as sharp, actually, and this is probably still an idealization, I don't expect it to last, but it's still as sharp as it usually used to be. But then if they try to do reverse history and say, what source produced this? Two boosted observers get disagreeing pictures of the source. Okay? But this is a topic if somebody wants to discuss later, because this is more on the details of the technical debate, and I'm already at an hour. Do I take 5 more minutes or just to flash? Because this is my old stuff, really, with some new technical things, but this is my old stuff. And I'm trying to, I'm of course more excited about the new things I'm doing, which of course work even worse than the old ones, but of course the new love is best love. And so one idea that I'm starting to play with that perhaps can be also of interest to the perimeter community is, I promised I wouldn't do quantum gravity and I'm still not doing it, but it's interesting that these things we are starting to understand or imagine of quantum space-time can be used in ways to modify gravity. Or gravitational phenomena. Let me show you this. This is actually not gravity modified, but this is something for gravitational collapse. Now, keep again in mind this deformation of the dispersion relation, ultraviolet deformations. And forget about the formula of the speed of sound, let's just go to the qualitative picture. The qualitative picture, because the exciting point here, macroscopic objects, I did write it. So, for a fermionic system, the recent thing that I start to realize is that for a fermionic system, these modifications of the dispersion relation can become macroscopic effect, macro. Okay. And the reason is that when you have a fermionic system of many, many particles, the Pauli repulsion, am I saying something totally crazy? The Pauli repulsion, the Pauli exclusion principle, forces the fermions to occupy very high levels even when the average momentum is far from. So actually we have done some calculations using the Landau model for stars, so just basically a ball of fermions, okay, not a very realistic model, but what what we find is that basically the Fermi pressure or the Pauli exclusion principle pressure is significantly higher for a star when it gets to a size which is not Planckian. So let me go back to why this is surprising. I mean, in quantum gravity literature, everything becomes important when the size is Planckian. Black holes are funny when they're Planckian. Stars maybe are funny when they're Planckian. Area are funny when they're Planck length squared. What, again, with Loré, Mandanici, and Mercati as the key forces of this project, and me responsible for these weaknesses, what we started to realize is that when you have a many fermion system, okay, think of a ball, a star described like a ball of a certain radius, okay, the naive quantum gravity argument would say, well, when the ball becomes of Planckian length, of Planckian radius, the quantum gravity disaster occurs. But if there are quantum gravity effects of the source of this very small modification of the dispersion relation, what happens is that the Pauli exclusion principle forces some fermions to be on very high energy levels, even when the average energy of the fermions in the system is not that high. And we actually found that, for example, the regime where the description is profoundly different from, you know, the level when these effects are of order one, okay, in the quantum gravity literature, when is the quantum gravity effect of order one? At the Planck scale. Well, this is a definite example, which I'm not describing clearly enough in these few minutes, but this is a definite example of doing a simplified model where we can show that the effects become order one when the star is far from being Planckian. It depends on how many fermions are in the star. Actually, this formula collapses, goes order one different from the classical case, not when the star is of Planckian size, but it depends on how many fermions. It can be a macroscopic star.
How does it compare to the Chandrasekhar mass?
Not that macroscopic. I mean, so this is on the level of modeling we have now. We could have quantum gravity order one effects with realistic numbers when a star, if I remember correctly, is 10 to the minus 15 meters in radius. Okay, this might not be too impressive as I say it. I know. But if you think about Coriolis, is a revolution. It could be a revolution. Because I don't have the right model. I don't have the right star. I'm not sure. I'm just making the point that when there is the Pauli exclusion principle at work, we don't need to go to the regime of Planckian scales. 10 to the minus 15 meters looks terribly small for a star. But it's much bigger. I mean, it's much closer to being a star than to being the Planck length. You see what why it's...
Yeah, but it's going to be behind the horizon. Oh, if you make it so small, it's like...
Yes. No. But this is in a model where, you know, it's a Landau model. I'm just... Is there some way we can go with this? Of course, this is not what we are going to use explicitly, but I think it's my first. I don't know if anybody else had a better example already, but this is my best example to actually show you that there is a scale which is not the Planck scale where the effects go to order one.
No, but this is a Planck scale. What you're doing, you're putting axons or nucleons at the Planck length from each other. That's what you're saying. You say that Fermi momentum is 1 over L Planck.
So well, but there are only very few of them at that distance. When the Fermi momentum is that, you still have the, you know, many fermions are at momenta lower than the Fermi momentum.
Well, but they are aboard the distance of the order L Planck, right? That's so Fermi momentum is the average distance of or the distance of closest atoms or
is the distance of closest atoms.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, this is one way to say. But the object is macroscopic. It's 10 to the 20 times. Yeah. Is 10 to 20, of course, I mean, there is no cheating. I mean, of course, there is somewhere the Planck scale. But what I'm saying is that this ingredient at the Planck scale may manifest on a scale in this rudimentary model is 20 orders of magnitude bigger.
But you see the problem, you know, if you ask, say, a particle physicist, they would tell you can never put two particles at a distance of Planck to each other because their Compton wavelength is much bigger than Planck. So, I mean, that's what you're doing. You're putting two particles at distance of Planck, sub-Planckian particles at distance of a Planck length from each other. But that cannot be done easily because their Compton wavelength is much bigger than.
Well, there is gravitational pressure. I mean, this is not a realistic model. I'm just illustrating the possibility that we might have maybe one day a phenomenology of macroscopic effects rather than on single particles.
Well, can you turn the, what, I mean, can you estimate how large this would be for a neutron star? Turn it around. Make force the star to be
small,
a couple of kilometers in radius and then ask... What is it? Is it presumably down by 10 to 15?
It will be done. No, this is very recently. I don't have this answer, but this is the direction where one should go. More realistically, it should be neutral stars, not white dwarfs, because
yeah,
you
so
want something.
Stars.
Yes. No, as you said. I mean, this is basically instead more thinking of a white dwarf type of description.
I mean, 10 to the minus 5, that's the size of a proton, right? So you can't make a star the size of a
proton. No, but I mean, the seminar is ended because I didn't bring the charger. Okay, this I will not say. Maybe in the discussion. I mean, the other.
Is the charger in your office? I'll go get
it. No, I can get it, but I mean, people, I don't think they want to stay longer than. You don't have the key to my office, or you do? Okay, thank you, Akin. You should bring the whole bag of the computer because it's hidden in there. Well, but I only have a few final remarks. For example, this comment I just made about gravitational collapse, however rudimentary, was actually not modifying gravity. I was modifying the Fermi pressure. If you see, the argument was still not gravity. But in principle, you could, these modified propagation laws are also relevant. You know, what we call the Newton potential, you can obtain essentially by Fourier transform of the propagator at zero energy. Okay, so this is a way to estimate what modification of the Newton potential you should expect when you modify the propagator. And what I haven't shown before, yes, I completely skipped it, was a very small effect. The ultraviolet modification, for example, when we did this exercise of comparing the Fermi pressure to the gravitational pressure, we also took into account of the modification of the propagator for the gravitational pressure. But that one becomes important only at the Planck scale. Okay, so the dominant effect was the Fermi pressure. Now, the other new thing that I'm really excited about is the phenomenology based on IR UV mixing. There are various models of or intuition about the quantum space-time issue, and there are very good papers to read. I think this one especially makes a very clear general case for IR UV mixing, and this makes a very robust case for IR UV mixing in one of these non-commutative space-times. IR UV mixing is the idea that we introduce the Planck scale as a UV feature, but there is always that we expect a price to pay also in the far infrared. The simplest argument people use is from space-time non-commutativity, and it is just noticing that if you write it an uncertainty principle for space-time coordinates like this, like many people are tempted to do, okay, delta x delta y greater than L Planck squared. This also tells you as implication for the infrared, because if you make delta epsilon very small, you are forced to make delta x very large. It creates a mixing between properties of the theory in the infrared and the ultraviolet. And this is then seen very clearly, for example, in this type of approach by constructing quantum field theories in non-commutative geometry. And I think it's a good reminder that I used all of my time. But But the last point I was trying to make is that motivated by this literature on infrared ultraviolet mixing, I played the game of analyzing how the Newton potential could be modified by these infrared effects. And for one formulation of infrared ultraviolet mixing, it was already in the literature, I got a Newton potential that corresponds to a Newton force which goes like with a correction term of type 1 over R. So a logarithmic correction to the potential, which could have other reasons of interest, but this maybe we can discuss then in the quantum gravity discussion. Okay, let me stop here. It was work in progress, so I apologize if I ran out of time.
This issue then about what people see here versus over there. Mm. I mean, it seems the key challenge phenomenologically is figuring out whether some discrepancy here is a quantum gravity effect or something that's going on with the source we don't understand. So it seems to me one way of getting at this is if I found the discrepancies locally relative to what standard physics would expect,
mm-hmm.
were sort of isotropic in all directions, that would suggest not the source, because then a conspiracy of the type you mentioned earlier would have to happen. Is that a fair assessment?
I mean,
that would be one way of testing it, presumably.
This is one way of testing, but which goes in the spirit of what I however think is still the best way of testing. I mean, you have this sharp prediction of a dependence of what goes wrong, of the anomaly, on redshift.
Yeah.
The more distant objects should produce more anomalous time of arrival features, the closest object much less, and you have a definite formula, although we now discovered we have two. But I mean, you have at least a definite qualitative behavior with redshift that you expect.
Yeah, so I agree,
so,
it has to match that, but it's... was stated earlier by Weeks. I mean, I know you're going to say that it would have to conspire to exactly
to
match
stay
that
exactly
formula.
On one of these formulas.
But the real world has messy error bars that are probably worse the farther you go out. So I don't expect them to be constant. I expect the error bars to get bigger. Maybe. So.
Oh, this is a good point. I mean, you
more
could...
than just redshift. I would wonder if isotropy would help. That's why I'm asking that.
I guess, but it's not going to be a very... Because you probably, any model that tells you that also these delays are due to how old the source is, okay, so how young, if you want, how far it is, they will also be roughly isotropic. So the reason why I'm concerned is that maybe it's not going to work out very well to distinguish between the propagation effect, because isotropy is easily made also... Instead, you know, to stay... Of course, what you're saying is also true. I mean, the data that I imagine as a theorist as points on a line, they will be points with big error bars on a line. And so you need high statistics, and God knows if in 20 years or a few centuries we will have them. In principle, as I was trying to say, in principle, it's an exciting thing, and I think it's also... You know, an interesting aspect of how powerful sometimes phenomenology is. It's interesting that you, in principle, could do this not knowing anything of the sources. But, wow, it would be much better to have at least a partial understanding of these sources. Right now, what I notice, and I'm not an astrophysicist, what I notice is that before Fermi turned on, there were several dogmas that as soon Fermi was turned on, and he found things that were in contrast to these dogmas, the astrophysics community changed its dogmas in 48 hours. For example, short bursts, for me, it would have been very important a few years ago to know that a short burst, one with very good time quality, because less short time, short in the sense of time, if I could have hoped that a short burst produced high-energy photons, I would have made much bolder claims 10 years ago. But there was a dogma. The short burst don't produce high energy photons. So for many years I used conservative estimates. Fermi is turned on, and the second high energy burst was a short burst, and the most energetic one was a short burst. And so now short bursts can do. Okay, this is not, you know, it's, of course, it's very, you know, astrophysicists do the best they can, but the situation is so much under development, they don't provide us an environment where the study of space-time properties is at best.
Just a general comment. Do you think that it's unless I'm forgetting one of your examples, they were all based on a modified dispersion relation. So they were all based on some form of Lorentz violation or Lorentz deformation, if you can make sense of that.
There can be many other effects that do not just rely on those. Exactly. For example, it's just very difficult. The few examples, for example, kind of striking result of this recent, this may be still Lorentz violation in some sense, but this is introduced as a violation of the de Broglie relation, lambda v equal 1 over m, in the non-relativistic regime. And this is a result that I really would have liked to go to, but I ran out of time.
But it still looks frame dependent naively
anyway. Yeah, yes.
C is in some frame.
Yes, but, well...
I'm thinking there's whole other classes that depend, for example, on processes of an underlying discreteness. And there can, I just want to make the point that there can be effects of discreteness or quantum gravity more generally that are consistent with Lorentz invariance, and that in principle are phenomenologically, in the naive sense of Lorentz invariance, and that are phenomenologically observable, or one could put bounds. So, for example, there are completely Lorentz invariant models for the diffusion of the momentum of a propagating particle on the mass shell. These are a photon.
Well,
and you can put quite strong bounds on those using, for example, the thermality of the Planck.
I don't know if you can claim that you go. I don't know if one can really claim that there is a Planck scale bound. But let me also stress this. This gamma ray burst story, okay, I've emphasized here this velocity type. This would be clearly requires going beyond Lorentz symmetry. But there is for some people might be more conservative, I'm not sure, but for me it's experiments that say, but some people might prefer other pictures the phenomenologists, not so much the experimentalists, because the data are a bit more challenging for that. You can have models where the photon, on average, stays on the light cone, on the classical light cone, but the light cone is fuzzy. Okay? This is something you can get in many pictures. Okay? So not so much, this is a systematic effect of dependence, this is a systematic effect of dependence of arrival times on momenta, if you want. But you could have that the average in a bunch of photons, the average arrival time is just one of the classical theory, but there is some dispersion on top of that. Yeah, these data are very good also for that, because what you would see...
I kind of doubt that can be made Lorentz invariant. What you can make Lorentz invariant is that the frequency of the photon undergoes some kind of diffusion or fluctuations in a Lorentz invariant way. You can also have a Lorentz invariant drift in the frequency. Systematic drift. We can discuss it later. Yes, I'd like to. Yes, actually I need to learn that. So for that maybe take 5-6 minute break, and then you've got your second round.
It's probably up and back because I think there's a board meeting here, but I will actually, why don't I run down and check that, just in case they change their plans. So we'll meet in Bob, but we'll move down here.